Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and my very best wishes for you. Washes for you, which is probably,
yeah, there you go.
probably more accurate. if you survive New Year's Eve.
It is a new
fresh,
year now.
Yeah, fresh, clean, and in 2015.
And it's our 12th year.
It is it's hard to believe. Yes.
Unbelievable, and we hope many of you have been with us for many of those years, and that you'll stay with us for many years to come.
Well,
are we doing today?
Well, we have a variety of people, but with interesting stories and interesting books. Starting out with somebody we always love to talk to. Not only is he an iconic chef in his own right, but he's mixed this cookbook that he's written in with all kinds of stories of his colleagues and his journey, and it's a memoir as much as a cookbook, and very interesting. And this is Norman Von Aken, and
no experience required.
No experience required. Yeah, Peter just picked up the phone with Norman Von Aken about his new book called No Experience Necessary, and said to him, "You sound like you had a very giddy life." I said, no, giddy's not the right word. It's called, he's a wild child. He was a wild child. But you settled down, and this book has value in the sense of not only just telling your story and your journey to becoming one of the most well-known chefs in the world, but also it sort of lays out the whole development of that period of American cooking.
Yes, the many great blurbs and contributions that came in from the chefs, the wine producers, and some of the writers, I think were a little bit, it was a shock of recognition when they read the book that came out. And it's like, yeah, it's become a lot more politically correct and expected that you'll lead a professional and dignified life if you're a chef. Well, 25 years ago, no one was traveling underneath those illusions.
Yeah.
Now, hold on just a second. Now, how many, you were going for the Rokathon of blurbs, right?
Going for which?
You were going for the Rokathon of blurbs.
Yes,
it's the latest way of saying a Guinness World Book of World Records, I guess. Now it has to be called a Rokathon. My God, how this man dominates our life! But how many are there altogether? Did you count them?
I didn't count them. I think that would have been gauche.
It's like everybody I've ever heard of.
Well, interestingly enough, some just didn't fit inside of it, and so they're on the online version.
Yeah, that's funny.
Like Christmas every day there for a while, because I would just like turn to my wife or my publishing partner and go, wait a minute, did you just see what I just saw? Did you see who just gave us a blurb? And be like, Mario Batali just checked in, and then the next day it'd be like, Wolfgang Puck loves the book, and so it was just endearing
How does it work? I thought they invited people.
What happens is he sends them a small envelope containing little things that are green on one side and black on the other, or invites them to dinner or something.
In this day and age, you either get a copy, an unbound, uncorrected version of the manuscript with no pictures, or you can elect to get the electronic version. And I'd say 50% wanted the old-fashioned version, and 50% wanted the electronic version, and then they read the book just really without, nobody was reading anybody else's blurbs, and nobody was seeing public publicity tour or any of that stuff. They just read the script.
Well, but now, how did they know who to send it to?
Publishers send the book out, so they just would communicate with the publisher.
Well, I mean, they sent us books all the time, of course. But
this is at an earlier stage in the process, I guess.
At an earlier stage, they have to select people that know you, right?
Well, they asked me of people that I knew, and when I was first telling them who I knew, they were like, you know them?
Really?
Because, you know, these folks, they publish books on all kinds of subjects. They're not specific to food and wine by itself. Some individuals within their organizations that know these folks, but people who are doing books on tattoos and cats, clean your house in 2 minutes, and the great historians of the Middle East or whatever. I mean, they do books on all subjects. They don't know necessarily who, you know, the editor, the publisher of Bon Appetit, Barbara Fairchild, is, but everybody in our business knows who she is. Mm-hmm. And so they asked me, who would I, you know, who would I like to have? And when I told them, well, I'd like, you know, I'd like to see if Wolfgang Puck or Mario Batali or Thomas Keller would write about it. They were like, you know Thomas Keller? I'm like, well, yeah, he's not in the book because I left that particular scene out, but he's definitely part of life.
What did you leave out, Norman?
Oh, that might be part of the scene. A very funny incident in Mexico City that I'll just leave at that.
Okay. I see.
Well, let's go back to the very beginning and the outside of the book where the title is No Experience Necessary. Explain that.
I'll let you explain.
Yeah, but explain that.
I know you knew because
you read the book, but he'll be shorter than you.
it's a play on words, really. First, it's a factual moment that happened in life. I was a person who had been working a series of odd jobs right after quitting college, and because I was going nowhere fast there. And I had been selling flowers on the street in Hawaii. I had been a carnival worker, really. I was a hot tar roofer and got fired from that job because a rainstorm made me delirious with laughter, and my boss didn't like the fact that I was delirious with laughter, and so I had to go get another job to help pay for the rent. And so I picked up a newspaper, looked at the ad section, and it said, short order cook needed, no experience necessary. And I was like, that's me, no experience. So I tied my ponytail up and stuck it down the back of a high school shirt that I dredged out of
that,
my closet.
Yeah.
And they hired me. And the next day when the ponytail slipped out, they were like, oh, my God, he's a long hair. This is 1970 in a little town in the Midwest. But they were good people, and they didn't just kick me out for that reason. And they saw that I was going to give it my all. And for the first time, I did give it my all. I gave a job my all. I was suddenly digging work as opposed to loathing work. And then, of course, the book, as you get through, you know, and see the episodes and the odyssey that it is, it's actually all I got was experience and all kinds of it.
And some of it was good and some of it was not so good.
Yeah. So it turned, the no experience necessary became ironic at the end. But, yeah, you know, I guess Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience by one of the poets, and mine is with Songs of Innocence and then Becoming Experience.
Well, you know, it's, I've read, what's the name's book on California, the Food Revolution.
Oh, it's Jeremiah Tower?
No.
Joyce Goldstein.
Joyce Goldstein.
Boy.
God, I can't remember.
Ah, Joyce, yeah.
I read her book, and it's funny because all of us who kind of lived through that, you don't really notice it until somebody's relaying it and relating it, and it takes you back, and then you realize that it was a moment. Did you have that feeling in just recollecting, and when you're setting out to write this book?
When I set out to write the book, a couple things happened. One is I was asked to participate in a book, which was a collection of sort of stories called Don't Try This at Home, and it was a book by a bunch of different chefs and their sometimes ghostwriters, who revealed a really harrowing tale of working in the restaurant business.
Mm-hmm.
And that was
I'm sure we saw that.
Put out by Kim Witherspoon's group. And they asked me, who wrote the story for you? I thought maybe I dictated parts of it. I said, well, I did. Weren't we supposed to? And they said, well, almost nobody, well, none of the chefs wrote their
really?
Own.
That's funny.
And so I kind of gained a little bit of, audacity or optimism or something. And I decided, well, maybe I should try this out. And so I decided to wake myself up with the alarm clock every morning at 5 o'clock and spend 2 or 3 hours writing.
Oh, is that what you did, huh?
I know, it was a shorter to cook when I first started, so I knew that alarm clock was around there somewhere.
Yeah.
I got it back out.
But I guess when you were experiencing, really, in real time, experiencing these various moments, did you have that, you didn't have the perspective on it, did you have the sense of history in the making?
No. Not until years later did I have the sort of viewpoint, the breadth of life to even think, oh, wow, this would be interesting in a book one day. It was no more like, I just hope I live through this. and I hope this becomes less harsh. And but sometimes it was like it was just dreadfully funny, and it was just goof. You know, you're just goofing there. You're like, wow, you know, that was hot oil that just blistered my skin. You know, that it was just life. It was life at the time. There was no turning inward for most of that until years and years later.
But you were palling around with, like, Emeril Lagasse and Charlie Trotter. You recognized that genius, didn't you?
Well, interesting. Charlie, as you know from reading the book, but Charlie was a busboy when he came to knock on my door.
Exactly.
He was a busboy in the dining room of the restaurant I was a chef of, and I just turned him away flatly, you know, like, we don't need anybody in the kitchen right now, young man. And he came back, like, the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and it's so amazing to us now to look back at that. My sous chef at the time, we were just cooking together in Chicago for a tribute to Charlie, and we were laughing about it because she was the one that said, let's give it a break, you know, let's give it a try. Make salads for a while and see what happens. What harm could come of that? And then, but like Charlie was like a rocket, not the first week, not the first month, but he came to work with me in restaurants after that. And it was like, came to work with me and then he'd go away, and he came to work with me and go away. And it was like a speeding bullet. I mean, he was learning so much, so fast. He wrote me so many postcards from his travels, and it was astonishing to see how on point he was with his ability to discern the subtleties of food, whether it was good or not good. It's like he didn't go through the normal learning curve that most people would have gone through. He got it almost intrinsically.
Yeah.
He subsequently introduced me to Emeril in around 1990, right when Emeril was leaving Commander's Palace to open up Emeril's.
Yeah, the triangle, you said.
The triangle. We were doing a dinner at Charlie's restaurant in Chicago, and somehow or another it became clear to us in a moment that, you know, we were geographically triangular, and we were sort of, from a way of looking at food, we were not all exactly the same. We had touch points that were the same, but we weren't the same, and somehow or another it leaped in our minds that magical day to call ourselves the triangle, and that became kind of like what other people called us after that, too.
You know, I loved your story about the Charlie. Another one of these endless parties where you ended up zonked out and woke up the next morning. But you said Charlie had brought toothpaste and toothbrushes and all this stuff. Isn't that Charlie, though? Isn't that perfect Charlie?
What happened was we had done this massive event and for hundreds of people. It was Julia Child's birthday. I think 300 guests, and it was one long, amazing, hard-working dinner party that turned into an after party, and the after party turned into a bit of a barroom brawl with me and Emeril breaking chairs over a bar in the Turnberry Resort because a very mischievous maitre d' decided to make unwanted advances toward my wife. And so the splintering chairs next to the maitre d's face set us off to go find more drinks, and more drinks led to me and Emeril actually ended up falling asleep fully clothed on top of the bedroom on top of the bed that they'd rented, and the wives, Janet and Terry at the time, escaped from our snoring drunkenness to the next room, and then Charlie came in the following morning to rescue us from the ravages of too much to drink.
But with all these practicalities, that's what I loved about it.
The aspirin, the bagels, the cream cheese. Yeah, it's like room service just got delivered.
Now, you, of course, were a pioneer of a whole new concept of food and of what is now, I guess people call it fusion food. And, of course, all the New American, and that was the fusion. But how now do you look at what's happening to the young pups and moving up in the restaurant world, in the chefing world?
I think it's a very interesting time in American cuisine. I think that there is a revival going on again. You know, every form of craft and art, I think, goes through these awakenings and renaissances and revivals and things. And then sometimes things become morbid and dreary, and then somebody kicks the hell out of it and starts it all over again, just like we did when we were doing our thing. And
New World cuisine is what I was struggling with.
That's what I've called it, because of geographical things. But there's a lot going on, and a lot of concern and care for where food comes from and how it's produced. And I think a lot of good things are going on in that route. And I think that there's a there's a whole cadre of chefs who are 40 and 30 and 25 years old that are very dedicated and on fire with the dream and drive that I think is consonant with what Charlie and Emeril and Thomas Keller and Mario Batali and Wolfgang Puck and, you know, the many people that are in the pages of this book not only were doing but remain doing. I mean, I think there's
a healthy amount
of us that still are producing new things and loving new things and caring about cuisine with the same zeal, although the difference is that we've got 30 or 35 or 40 years of experience.
Well, you know, of course, Charlie died so young and so suddenly, and everybody's just really excited about the Trotter project that you're working on, which you can explain a little bit later. But
sure.
One of the things you said, you would raise so much money with this dinner that was going to be done three times with star chefs, including you.
Yes.
The kind of money people are spending on food now, do you think that's getting a little bit excessive?
Well, I think that our forms of what we've decided to spend money on have changed a lot since the real estate fallout. So I think that the old adage was that you always plowed money into your house, and then how many Americans saw themselves lose their house or lose the value of their houses in such dramatic ways that I think they did was they always put money into land and home. And now I think people are being a little bit more like, you know, I'm going to try and enjoy my life while I'm alive. Maybe not have such a huge house and maybe not have like two cars. I just heard last night in the news that they expect in 15 years that there'll be more American homes with only one car than there has been since the 30s. And so I think the repositioning of what we value has some ways changed. I don't know that it's all for the best, but I do think that when people care about the food, and I don't mean fancy food, because I think a big part of what's going on has been about food in the schools and food for children. The food in the cafeterias. I mean, now more chefs are talking about doing and are doing simple kind of fast food styled QSR, sometimes is what it's called, restaurants,
yes,
in not caving into all of the manufactured, commercial, factory produced food. And so a broadening, a more democratic desire to produce food. So I don't know. I certainly don't think of it in some sort of Calvinistic way, which is probably no surprise for anybody that's read the book. But
we just talked with someone a couple of weeks ago, in fact, he's in Texas. His name is Jack. Is it Gilmore?
Yeah.
Jack Gilmore. And he has several restaurants. But he said at one point in time, he said, here's what I decided to do. I got all the local farmers together and I said, whatever you grow, I'll buy it. If you agree to grow for me, then don't worry about the fact that you won't be able to sell what you grow, because if you bring it to my back door, I'll pay you for it.
Yeah, and it's sort of like the CSA approach to buy a restaurant.
But like 100% CSO, it's CSA.
CSA.
And he said, I can do it because I have four or five different restaurants, but then they're on the hook. They know they have the opportunity to bring me stuff, and if they don't bring it to me, then it's on them that they didn't grow it.
Well, the chef from New York, Dan Barber, new book, The Third Plate, really addresses that. I have not read it, but I was just at the Star Chef's ICC Congress where I was presenting, and Dan was one of those speakers also, and he, the distillation of that book, I thought very
brilliant.
Well.
It's brilliant, absolutely brilliant, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, it's not just, you know, how we're going to do farm-to-table, but how we're going to cook the farm, how we're going to find out, you know, all the things that need to be utilized to nurture the soil so that farms can be replenished. And so there's a lot there to take on. It's really the dynamic way of looking at cooking.
Well, I like your answers. They're always thoughtful. I like the book because it's a real rock and roller.
And, oh, by the way, there does just happen to be a recipe or two at the end of
every chapter.
So buy it for the recipes too. I tested it out. I looked at the latke recipe.
Oh yeah, that's.
And I said, you know what? He's got a couple of things in here that I never tried. And I'm up to I have to cook latkes for grandchildren next week.
Well, I'm a Methodist-raised boy from the Midwest, so latkes were not something I grew up with. But I'll tell you what, they pass muster amongst my friends of the other faiths.
Yeah, well, Peter's not exactly, he was not raised on latkes either. In Yorkshire, England.
The only potatoes I got were mashed or chips.
Oh, well, I hope, Norman, that you do really well with this, and I want to stay closer than I've been to the Trotter Project, because I think that's really a wonderful thing, and of course, I mean, I love Charlie.
Anne, thank you so much. There will be some wonderful opportunities for you to have folks from the Trotter Project that can speak to the chapter and verse on all of it and all that's going on.
They're keeping a lot under wraps, though. You know, I'm in communication constantly with Derek Hull from Motown.
I think
it's going to be unrolled with some drama over a period of time, all the details, right?
I guess so. I'll be there in whatever way I can to support.
Yeah, well, I think you're wonderful, and I always enjoy talking to you. And I think that you really kind of have me excited with the thought that things are actually in a stage where they're going to start perking up food-wise and chef-wise, yes. And good things are coming.
My pleasure. Great to be on the show, and I look forward to doing it again someday.
Great. With your next book.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm waiting to hear what this next book's going to be.
I don't know myself, but in the meantime, I'm opening up the cooking school, so stay tuned for that one.
Oh, okay. We never even talked about that. All right, well, keep me posted on the cooking school.
I will, Ann. Thanks.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, our next guest is actually not somebody we've known for a long time. We just met up with him. But I think you're going to find him a real breath of fresh air.
It's a truly remarkable story.
Oh, yeah. He and his wife, Jill, I mean, the two of them, and they're right up front with everything, and I think you're going to really enjoy what they're doing.
And the story
of hearing about what they're doing. I don't think you'd enjoy trying to do what they're doing.
How they got from a few pots of herbs outside the back door to a 130-acre farm is really, and by the way, they have a couple of restaurants, too. But anyway.
I love those animals. I mean, they're really interesting animals.
It's a fascinating story, even though you might not want to do it yourself.
Eric Skokin.
Yes.
Your book, Farm Fork Food, A Year of Spectacular Recipes Inspired by Black Cat Farm, is a delight to read. I think that people are going to... there's so much of you in this book. Let's back up a little bit. Before we went on the air, you mentioned something sort of referencing yourself as a Don Quixote of sorts, and I think you are.
Thank you.
Could you just explain to us what your motivation was in opening the Black Cat Farm, your restaurants, and being so literally at right there growing all your own produce?
Sure, indeed. Well, I have to say that when I started farm, it was really just a garden. And the quixotic mission, the Don Quixote-inspired life that my wife and I lead now, that it really hadn't shown itself yet. The garden initially was there to provide the little leaves and the flowers and herbs that I would sprinkle on the dishes at the end of cooking, the things that make people excited, chefs certainly excited to see, and things that leave an air of freshness to the dishes when they're coming out of the kitchen. That was one of the purposes, and the other one was stress relief. As anyone who started a restaurant knows, it's a really stressful endeavor.
Yeah, I did that.
all day focus. You're in the kitchen during dinner service, but it's really this all-consuming. Restaurants consume your life. It's an all-consuming endeavor.
And so I started this garden as a way of taking a step back from the rigor, the pace of the restaurant, and to have a really quiet time in the morning. Every morning I would go out, just a couple steps outside of the kitchen door. It was this garden that I had planted. I would be in the sunshine wearing my big straw gardening hat, watering the plants. I'd shuffle around in my slippers, my cup of coffee. And it was a great way to kind of get perspective on what was happening in the restaurant and think clearly through issues. You know, and at the same time, I was growing these little, just really delicious, really delicate things that I could use in the restaurant. So kind of killing two birds with one stone, so to speak. So then, like many things, when you do something that you love, it's really easy to want to do a little bit more of it. And so I fell in love with gardening. I was successful at it. The produce from the garden was wonderful, and so I planted a little bit more. In fact, I doubled the size of the garden later that summer, and then the next year I doubled it again, and then doubling it just kept happening over the first couple of years, such that in year three we were transitioned from a garden, you know, a really big garden at that point, into a small farm. We made that transition and ended up growing 5.5 acres of vegetables. And even when we were doing that, it wasn't really even intentional. We did it because we had the opportunity and we wanted to try it out, but we had no grand plan for anything beyond, certainly not to the extent that we're growing now, but we were successful. My wife and I, we loved it. It really spoke to us as people, and certainly helped the restaurant out as well. And so the doubling continued. And now fast forward 7 years later, and the farm is 130 acres.
Oh, wow.
We have animals, cattle, sheep, pigs, chickens, 1,200 chickens a year, big flock of sheep. And then, of course, we do all the vegetables that you can think of. And then tons of depth and tons of varieties of things. And then lots of vegetables most people haven't heard of.
Like what?
Well, cardoons was one of the things that we've done this year in a very large quantity. Artichokes don't grow well in Colorado. In fact, they're as close to impossible to grow as you could get. But cardoons, a cousin of an artichoke, does grow really well. So we concentrate on that.
Yeah, we managed to grow a few of those, but
Didn't do well.
They didn't do well, and the artichokes not at all.
But Colorado is very different.
Yeah.
Colorado, weather-wise, is a whole lot different than we're used to in the northeastern United States. And I was going to ask you: did you discover that it just happens to be really good for growing vegetables, or would you just get lucky, or because it's not something that happens a lot?
Well, there's now that I've grown for 7-8 years, grown things for 7 or 8 years solid, I can start to see the pattern. At the time, everything that I did was luck. It was luck that turned out spectacularly well, or it turned bad luck that turned out spectacularly poorly. But I learned a little bit, you know, each year along the way, and I'm still learning. This year, we grew for the very first time sesame seeds. So we supply our own sesame seeds in the restaurant. And prior to this year, I had never touched a sesame seed plant, never even seen the picture of one.
I don't know what it looks like.
Oh, it's a gorgeous plant. Oh, it's such a gorgeous plant. I'm surprised people don't grow sesame as an annual in their ornamental gardens.
Well, it comes out of Africa, doesn't it? It's a Benny, isn't it?
It does, yes. Erect stalks for the plant with dark green foliage in diamond-shaped pattern, alternating diamonds, and the most gorgeous lavender blossoms that come off of the stalk like little trumpets, and then those are followed by a seed pod that looks just like okra. At first glance, you think, oh, that's an okra plant, but no, it's a sesame. And it blooms all season long, so it starts blooming in late May, and it'll bloom until the first frost, and really just a gorgeous, gorgeous plant. So I'm addicted to growing sesame now. We'll do probably a half an acre, which is, you know, maybe close to a million plants this next year.
Can we grow sesame?
I doubt it very much. I mean, one of the things that Colorado undoubtedly has is it has a whole lot of sunshine.
Yeah.
And if you have a whole lot of sunshine and you add water, then you have an environment in which most crops will grow a lot better than they do in the northeastern yeah. United States. I mean, it just is the way it is, because you can intervene with the part of the process that's short, which is water. But you can't intervene by providing more sunshine. The sun either shines or it doesn't. There were two stories that really caught my attention, and I want to tell one of them, and then I want you to tell the other one. And I'm going to give you Buttercup, because Buttercup is such an unusual development along the way. But the thing I thought was the most amazing was when you said you the first time you grew peas, and you picked some peas in the morning on one of your morning walks, and you took them, you tasted them, and they tasted wonderful, and then you took them to the restaurant, and then you forgot to cook them.
Yeah.
And then the next day you remembered the peas and you tasted them, and they weren't the same. You said they weren't nearly as good, and that taught you something really vitally important about the importance of absolute freshness, which you can achieve, which David Kinch and Manresa can achieve, which a variety of, yep. of a small number of other chefs in the United States have been able to achieve, because the time from garden to table is measured significantly less than 24 hours. Now, tell us about Buttercup.
Sure. So Buttercup is my affectionate name for my favorite tractor. And at this point, we have many, many tractors.
It's a tractor. It was your first tractor.
7 or 8 of them. But my heart will always belong to Buttercup. So when I close my eyes and I picture my old family farm in upstate New York, I picture sitting on my grandfather's lap. The tractor that we drove was an International Harvester Farmall. And it's the same as Buttercup. So I jumped at the chance when I saw one for sale to buy it, and instantly I was transported back to the farm and sitting on my grandfather's lap. And it was really wonderful that first summer, learning about the tractor again, learning about how it operated and plowed and did all the work. And of course, not an expert at farming, and so I was really learning via YouTube and conversations with my dad, and trying to recount all of these stories and lessons of how to operate this tractor. Undersized front wheel that seems to wobble and wander across the field, incredibly hard to keep the tractor driving straight. When I would take a look, step back and look at the fields that I had planted that first summer, and then look at the rows, none of them were straight. Not only were they not straight, you know, they were all over the place. Undulating is about the nicest way that you could, you know, the nicest description you could come up with for the look of the rows, and really closer to my cardiograph is what they ended up looking like in the end.
Now, but this is just such a. I wanted you to spend some time on this, because at one level, this is just such a wonderful adventure story of you and your wife and your children and the creation of this farm. But we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this is also a book. But
indeed.
But it's a very unusual cookbook. You write in your book that having the farm available changed the way you created your menus. Because you used to have things on the menu for several months because you'd know you'd always be able to get the ingredients because you bought them from somebody else having grown them or prepared them in some way. And now you're doing something different. Your menus are changing much more frequently. And then what you've done, I guess, is to show us what those menus look like now. So they're the menus of the Black Cat Bistro, made presumably accessible for the home chef. But to incorporate some of these magical ingredients that you now have access to.
So that is all correct. One way of looking at the dishes, well, and hopefully everyone who comes into the restaurant, they look at the dishes in the cookbook or the ones that we're serving at the moment in the restaurant, and they seem similar to what one might see in another restaurant. Nothing, you know, necessarily earth-shattering or groundbreaking. But at the same time that everything looks the same, it's also completely different. We operate the restaurant differently. We source, obviously, differently. And how we construct the dishes in the restaurant is different as well. How I train all the cooks in the kitchen is different. So what I've done in the cookbook is used some of the dishes that illustrate the basic tips and tricks that I use for transitioning from, you know, the excitement that you feel at the farmer's market. You see wonderful leeks there, and you think, oh, I really have to cook these leeks. These are going to be spectacular. And then when you make it home, you think, oh, no, I have these great leeks, but I don't want to goof them up. I want them to be great. So this is a book, because I deal with that issue all the time, being inspired in the fields and then wanting it to be successful in the restaurant. So this book and the dishes are really a blueprint for making that transition from the field into the restaurant. One of the, for example, in each one of the recipes, it's broken down into different components. And the components themselves can be taken out of the context of the dish and things rearranged. And that's something that we need to accomplish on a daily basis in the restaurant. The harvest today is always different than the harvest from tomorrow, and so the menu needs to adjust. The arugula, oh, it's a little too spicy now, and so we'll move on to a different green. But you can't retool a kitchen in a restaurant completely every day, so you need dishes that can accept change really well. So if a dish, for example, calls for kale, then quite often Swiss chard is really spectacular. And I've also given a lot of time in the book to talk about how the vegetables change over time. So, for example, kale in the summertime is never as tasty as it is in the fall. Fall, it takes on a rich sweetness balances out its pepperiness. In the summer, it can be really fairly peppery, and dishes that you would use kale in the summer obviously should be a little bit different. So you take all those things together and then fast forward into the book once you've had a chance to go through everything, and you really get a sense of how the seasons dictate the dishes in our restaurant as well as in the home.
Now, is it your book? We see so many cookbooks, and I've seen a few within the last few days. Is your cookbook one? It has a recipe in it for sunchokes. Sunchokes is one of the ingredients.
Yes.
It's funny. It turns out that we have sunchokes we cannot eradicate from our garden.
we can't, it's the gift that keeps on giving.
We can't get rid of them. But the gardening assistant we used during the summer dug some out and dug them out too early because she didn't wait until after the frost. So the one she picked, we just threw them away. Well, it turns out that I was cooking lamb stew last night, and then said, "Aren't the Jerusalem artichokes? They would go in that." So I got my trusty spade and dug away and found just enough sunchokes to go with the other root vegetables with the leg of lamb that I had cubed that I was making into dinner. Now, it seems to me like if you used your recipes intelligently, you'd be able to do the same thing, because you'd be able to say, well, I've got this ingredient. Now, what can I put with that to make a complete dish?
Indeed, and I think you can approach it in two different ways. One way would be with the ingredient as the starting point, and frankly, that's how I generally cook. I'll leave the fields, and I'll have something in my hands that I'm just really excited to work with when I make it back into the kitchen. And then another way would be taking a technique first and then crossing it, referencing it back to different vegetables. Does this seem applicable? Does that seem applicable?
Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. I love making gnocchi, and we do it two ways, with potato, and then we make the nudie style, which is made with fresh cheese. And then we poach that. Poach the gnocchi in the way of the cheese after making the cheese. And that's a wonderful technique, a wonderful dish that can accept lots of different vegetables coming out of the field. So going back to the leek example from braised leeks and then crispy sunchoke pieces and then maybe a sauce made with walnuts, boom, 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 all together with gnocchi, it would be a spectacular dish all based on that beginning technique of making gnocchi or nudie.
You're an amazing young man.
Oh, thank you.
Really quite amazing. All of this in only part of a lifetime.
I love learning. And that's one of the discoveries I've made in farming. I decided, even though I feel I am an expert at cooking and I'm approaching proficiency in farming, I've decided that being an expert is not of great interest to me. I really want to know everything. I opened the door to the farming world, and I discovered all these brand new things to think about and learn, and it's been so much fun, so incredibly rewarding. Yeah, yeah. And now I'm interested in continuing that.
Yeah, even as technical things I've learned along the way, that I don't know that most people realize it, that you're supposed to know it or that they don't know it.
Right.
Yeah, and from what you just said, you're going to continue doing this, but you're just going to expand. You have two restaurants. We ought to get that straight, too.
Yeah, we have the two restaurants. My wife and I are planning now on, we're renovating our barn, and we hope to do dinners inside the barn at the farm, which we're really excited about as well.
You know about dinners in the field, right?
Yes. We've done many of them, and the afternoon rain showers that we occasionally have prompted us towards renovating the barn with greater haste.
I guess.
Exactly.
Great. But if people want to go to Black Cat Bistro, Black Cat Bistro is in Boulder itself, correct?
It is. Downtown Boulder, just off, just a few feet off the historic walking mall.
Great. And then there's another restaurant in Boulder as well?
Indeed. Next door, we opened a small pub in the traditional sense of a pub called Bramble and Hare. Very small menu, very small kitchen. The menu is conceived similar to what I cook for my wife and family at our home in the farmhouse. It's a quick collection of ingredients that we harvest, and then very straightforward family style food, braised pork shoulder with polenta and greens, for example, or a quick chocolate eclair for dessert.
Great. And there's a website that where people can find out about all of this, which is?
Indeed. Brambleandhare.com would be for our pub, and blackcatboulder.com is our website for
okay,
the
let's domain. Let's do those again. Bramble and A-N-D spelled out.
Bramble and A-N-D spelled out, hare.com. And that's hare as in the rabbit, H-A-R-E.
Okay, great. Thank you for mentioning that. And it's Black Cat Boulder.
Blackcatboulder.com.
Great.
Well, I keep having fun, Eric. We didn't hear from your wife to see if she was having as much fun as you are.
Well, my wife, her hidden desire has been to be, she's an accountant, but she's always wanted to be a vet. And now with our animal operation, she is handling all the breeding operations and all the vet, you know, issues that always come up on a big farm.
Well, you have such an assortment of them. You don't have routine pigs and stuff. You have really unusual things. You have what are those cows, the Scottish
things? You have those wonderful Highland cattle.
Our Scottish Highland cattle, indeed.
They're something to see. They're obviously popping up on a road in Scotland.
The pictures you have in the book, they look very small and tame. When you see the bulls walking down the main road in Kyle of Loch Alsh in Scotland, which is the first time I ever encountered one, it's really rather frightening. They look like they'd gore you in just a second.
And indeed they would. Although ours are playful, much, much larger than they are in the photographs now.
Okay.
They are each around 1,200 pounds, but they haven't lost their playfulness. So with the long spread of their horns and their desire to run and jump, it makes it a little dangerous.
A little challenging. Yes.
Well,
a little challenging.
We have had such an enjoyable time talking with you, Eric, and we wish you and your family continued success. And I anticipate that we'll talk again in the future, and certainly if we're headed in your direction, Denver or Boulder or anywhere close, we'll be sure to look you up.
It's been my pleasure, and thank you both so much.
Thank you, Eric.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
next up, we have, in my opinion, another very brave person, Dana Cohen, who took over as editor-in-chief at a young age, actually.
The Food and Wine Magazine.
Food and Wine Magazine. But
who knew she didn't know how to cook?
Well, I mean, she opened herself up to any kind of a nasty group. You know, I mean, people get to be very nasty, but she did an exceptional job with the magazine, and she actually had this idea. It was 2 years ago I heard about this book and thought, that's brilliant. She's brave. She comes right out front saying, I really am not a master chef, and I do make mistakes in the kitchen. But, of course, what she does have is, what, 65 highly talented chefs that come in there.
And here's how we can all improve.
Dana Cohen, I asked you off air, and then I'm going to ask you again. Dana is, of course, editor-in-chief of Food and Wine Magazine and has been for quite some time now. And I think that might surprise people that she did not feel very confident in the kitchen. So she produced a book called Mastering My Mistakes in the Kitchen, and she had 100 different recipes, 65 great chefs, and over 100 delicious recipes. But I said, Dana, truly, you really are not that inept in the kitchen. And what did you tell me?
I said, yes, I am. It's a very funny thing to want to claim ineptitude. But I guess I'm just claiming veracity, that I'm telling the truth on the cover of the book when I say I really did need to master my mistakes. And there's a reason I didn't grow up in a family that cooked. My mother never cooked. My grandmother never cooked. I never tried to make up for their shortfalls by cooking. I just ate really mediocre food all the time. And it didn't particularly bother me. And in fact, it didn't particularly bother me when I was cooking and entertaining for friends that things would burn, or they would overcook, or they would undercook, or they're underseasoned, or they're overseasoned. It didn't bother me until about 5 years ago, it started getting on my nerves, and I thought, I need to do something about this. I actually can learn to be a better cook. I do not need to accept, as I have for all these years, that my food will be imperfect and I will ruin something every time. I can fix that. And so now I only ruin things every other time.
No, but you actually got a husband by having a failed souffle.
I did. I have a fabulous husband, and the reason I knew he was fabulous was when I made a souffle for two, which, for any listener, just never, ever try to make that a date night food. It is a bad idea because you need to attend to it. So I served him essentially scrambled eggs in a pan, a flattened souffle, and he just thought that was terrific. You know, he just thought that was fine. And I thought anyone who would be so gracious about such an egregious cooking failure probably is a very tolerant human being. And so he passed my souffle test that I didn't even know I had. And he's now my husband.
Well, now you start with these 100 recipes, and they're all yours, essentially. And there was a problem that you had with most of them, but not all of them, right?
That's right. I'm an inept cook, but I am not a complete failure. So there are many dishes that I make at home that would be impossible to fail. For example, I love making chopped salad. I start with a hearty vegetable raw, like a cauliflower, and add something sort of salty, like a caper or an olive, and then I add something a little bit juicy, like an apple or a pear, and then add a nut, and it's all chopped to be bite-sized and tossed. I couldn't come up with an error with that if I wanted to, and then I couldn't find a chef that I could ask to help me because I had made no mistake. So there are recipes in the book that are for the cook who is just beginning, who doesn't really want to try to not, let's say, burn their bread.
Now, let's do a chicken and egg. What came first, the mistake or the chef you selected to fix it?
The mistake came first because my process was that I looked at all of the recipes that I loved over the last 30 years and said, okay, which of these have I had problems with, and which of these problems are worth solving? Because some of the things that I failed at, like I was making Indian food one night and had a problem with tamarind because I didn't know that tamarind pods had seeds in them. I mean, the whole thing was such a mess, but everybody did not need to know that. So I sort of made a hierarchy among my mistakes to figure out what people would really want and what they might have made a mistake with. And then I went and thought, which chef friend of mine would be really good to learn from on this topic? So, for example, my baked ziti arrabbiata, I went straight to Mario Batali. Right. In fact, that recipe is largely inspired by a dish of Mario, so he was the natural person. But I made a mistake there making a bechamel, which is sort of funny to learn how to make a bechamel from an Italian. But but he knows his way around a bechamella, or however you say it in Italian.
He really does. And some of them are so down to earth. So Jose Andres on bruschetta is advising you not just about how to make the topping, but how to make sure the bread's toasted properly.
Yes. I was almost not going to ask Jose how to make essentially a tomato topping for bruschetta, because I thought this might fall in the category of just too simple. But when I got in the kitchen with Jose and I explained that my first mistake was that I could not get my baguette toasty enough to then rub the tomato on top, he said, "Well, you're using the wrong bread." And I said, "What do you mean? Every foodie worth their Himalayan salt knows that you're supposed to use a baguette." And he said, "No. Do you have sliced bread in the house?" I said, "Sliced bread? I mean, people like me don't have sliced bread. Everything is supposed to be sliced a la minute at the moment of use." But I did find some sliced bread, and he showed me why that was better, because it has better holes to grate with. And then I said, "No, I'm really sorry. Here's my grill pan. We're going to have to grill inside." And Jose said, "But we shouldn't be grilling. Okay. We should be using a toaster oven." And I said, "Jose,
that's the part that I liked.
Because I assumed that all chefs in America want to use their grill one way or another. It's just almost like it's the secret to life. And so Jose made me cook the bread on a grill pan, and he cooked the bread in a toaster oven, and his was evenly toasted and browned, and mine was splotchy, naked in some parts, toasted in some parts. And I just thought, okay, right again, yeah. Toaster oven, here we come.
There you go. Now, that's a little bit like that crystal bread that they make in Spain. It's sort of like an appetizer where the bruschetta is broken down even further, and you just sort of spread it on like jam on a piece of toast.
I mean, that sounds fantastic, yes.
And it doesn't look very interesting, but it sure tastes wonderful.
Yeah. Well, he taught me one other thing, which is the next stage of cooking. But he takes a tomato, and then he opens up the seed pocket.
Oh, yeah, the seeds for caviar.
And takes just the little seed caviar, which is like a jewel, that he puts on top of his roughly chopped tomatoes. And that was beautiful. And it's more time-consuming than I might want to do on my, before my average party. But if I was going to just a couple of people over, I'm going to take the Jose way, get tomato jewels.
Has all this changed your confidence as well as given you tips? Or is it, you said before that it was personality traits or things?
Yes. I think that after doing this book, I feel instead of going to the kitchen to learn technique, I went to the kitchen and had therapy, which I did not expect. It was cheaper than therapy, to be sure, because I focused on what exactly went wrong here, as opposed to blithely going through. And when I focused on what went wrong, there were some major lessons that I felt like I could take away, but that were also really wonderful to share with readers. And those were around paying close attention when you cook, until you're a very confident cook and it's all sort of muscle memory and second nature. But if you're not a great cook, the way I'm not a great cook, you actually need to pay attention. You need to do the steps that they say in the recipe. You need to read the recipe completely first, and you need to have all of your ingredients lined up. I can't tell you the number of times I got to the middle of the recipe and then realized I didn't have enough oil, or, oh my goodness, I thought it said chopped tomatoes, but it actually said whole tomatoes. And these things can really end up messing up your recipes. So,
well, I have a wonderful bride story.
She has a great bride story.
This is worth including. I decided I would make Julia Child's choucroute garni.
Yes.
And so I got the ingredients, and I'm throwing everything into pots and doing what I'm supposed to. And then I hit the part of the recipe, which I, of course, had not read through, that says, "Now simmer for 5 hours."
Oh, exactly. Isn't that the worst? You get to the bottom, and you have people coming in 2 hours, and it says refrigerate overnight. And you're like, what? Why didn't you say that in the beginning? It looks like we're having pizza tonight.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that there are many different sections of the book that will be useful to the readers. Yours, certainly in the introduction, the things you learned about yourself and the things that chefs told you about the overall approach to cooking or your presence in the kitchen. But then you also have wonderful tips throughout, like of each recipe, like chef tips from Dan Barber on washing spinach, on spinach teeth. I mean, it's amazing.
Yes, I find that I have now tucked away all those little tips in my mind. So, for example, Dan Barber was teaching me to really wash spinach thoroughly, which is important because I once almost served my family inedibly gritty spinach at Thanksgiving until we washed the cooked spinach down to sort of 3 tablespoons, which then we plumped up with heavy cream, and it made it more palatable, but something I never wanted to repeat again. And I also didn't realize that poor soil is something that contributes to that sort of bad spinach taste. So having the chefs give me really specific, wonderful advice, that has changed my cooking forever, because I'll stop and I'll think, oh, well, I'm about to roast vegetables in the oven, and I want to be sure that the bottom doesn't burn, number one, and I want to be sure that they cook evenly. And so I'll do what April Bloomfield told me to do, which is double up the pan so that the heat is dispersed and that you don't have too hot a pan when roasting your vegetables, etc. Each chef taught me something that was so memorable and so simple.
And yeah, it's really useful advice. So I think that your audience ought to be pretty broad for this book, because it carries through from people just learning, beginning, to even people who've done it for such a long time but have missed some fine points.
Yes, and I'm hoping also that the book, that people enjoy it on 3 separate levels. One is just the recipes. You can ignore the tips. You could ignore me and my autobiography of failure. And you could just see that these are recipes that are of the moment today, but they're also a little timeless. And so they should add something new to the repertoire. But they're quite fast to prepare, and they're quite easy with accessible ingredients. So you could just pick it up as a cookbook, or you could really use it as an instruction manual to help you prevent yourself from making other mistakes, or you could really read it sort of as a comedy, because it is a comedy of errors. Well, for sure.
Let me tell you, you look like you're having such a great time in all these photos.
Well, that was true to life. Being in the kitchen with, let's say, Dave Chang. And
he's the one I was really looking at. You were having a ball.
I think it was my most embarrassing moment when cooking with these chefs was with Dave, because we were making quick cucumber kimchi.
Yes.
But Dave's an overachiever, so he also wanted to make a couple of other kimchis, and he told me to cut the cucumber with 4 slits, so I cut parallel slits, and he came over and saw that I'd cut parallel slits like fingers, and he hit his head. He's like, I can't believe you did that. That's not how you do it. Did you see what I did? Did you listen to what I said? And he just was so astonished, and I'm still laughing about it to this day, that I did not pay attention to Dave Chang.
Well, did you have a photographer with you for every session through the whole thing, huh?
I had a photographer with me for 2 weeks, and that was John Koenig, who's a really exceptionally talented photographer, and Susie Theodoro, who's an extraordinary stylist, and then Julia Tertian, who helped develop the recipes. So I feel it is the year of the team for me. I don't know about other people, but for me, it was an incredible team and an incredibly fun process.
How long did it take? How many?
I think from beginning to end, so from the first kernel of an idea, finding a publisher, to developing the recipes, to shooting it, to publishing it, it was probably 2.5 years.
Yeah, I remember thinking, somebody told me about it a long time ago, and I guess somebody from Food and Wine, so I guess that's been in the process for a while. And I thought then, I think now it's a great idea.
One of the tips that everyone should pay attention to, but I've picked it up a number of different places, but I think Thomas Keller was the first, which is, if you want your chicken to have crispy skin, you have to put it in the refrigerator to enable it to dry off, and then you can get crispy skin.
You have to put it in the fridge without being covered, which many people think is a terrifying and very unattractive thought. But Thomas believes in it wholeheartedly, and anyone who has followed that tip from Thomas, that's in my book, and as you say, he's said it other times before, will find that they actually have a crispy skinned chicken.
For the first time ever, they had a crispy skinned chicken. Now, here's another one, and actually, Anne helped me with this one, but I think it was Daniel Ballou who helped you with yours, because you were getting your meat ready to braise and you were browning it. And then you had this ingenious thought because you had all this nice bleeding part that you didn't want to throw out. So as you were browning the meat, you put that in there.
I know. At the moment, I'm like, I'm so proud of myself. I am not going to lose 1 ounce of flavor because I'm thinking, oh, all this red bloody juice must be so flavorful and it'll cook off and just lend its great character to my stew. But no, you never add a liquid when you're browning. So that was a big lesson for me.
Now, all you had to do was wait 10 minutes.
Yes, well,
till your meat was all browned, and then you can throw it in.
I can't. I have very good hindsight. So many things I could have done.
Well, you did swell with this book, Dana, and I think that it's going to be really useful to a lot of people. So congratulations on it.
Thank you so much.
And keep having fun in the kitchen. Yeah.
The wonderful thing about it is you have a smile on your face in every picture, and listeners, you can bet if you get this book and you read it through, you'll have a smile on your face too.
That's right, and a smile on your stomach.
Yes.
Do that.
Thanks, Dana.
Okay, take care. Bye. Bye.
So there you have it. We'll hope to see you again, same time, same place next week. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.